Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. The new book, Life of a Klansman, A Family History of White Supremacy, may sound like an extraordinary occurrence in one family story. But historian and author Edward Ball wants us to know having an active and enthusiastic bigot in your lineage isn't much of an outlier, and that a large portion of Americans are related to someone who was a participant in or adjacent to a white supremacist group. Ball earned a National Book Award for his first book, Slaves in the Family, about his father's side of the family. And now he tackles a biography of his maternal great-great-grandfather, Constant Lacorne, someone his family refers to as, quote, our Klansman. A carpenter and white Creole man in New Orleans, Constant fought for the Confederacy and was eventually arrested under the Ku Klux Klan Act for participating in an attempted coup. In committing his ancestor story to the page, Edward isn't hoping to inflate his significance. Instead, Edward argues that his great-great-grandfather was terrifyingly normal in his beliefs. He writes, "Our Klansman's story is not just a family story. It belongs to many. It is particular, but it carries with it a genealogy of race identity, of whiteness. It is the story of whiteness that is born into one life and grows, branching out into a tree that shelters others." Edward Ball joins me now. Edward, welcome to All of It.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So you have your great aunt Maud to thank for you knowing about Constant. She was the keeper of the family stories, and I didn't say family secrets, because she was open about Constant Lacorne. When she spoke about him, what was her tone like? Did she speak about him with admiration, with fondness?
Well, in the late 1960s, when I was a boy, the memory of Klansmen was changing in the Deep South. This was in New Orleans. And for about a century, most white Southerners were quite fond of the Ku Klux and what it accomplished. But by the late 1960s, my great aunt Maud would be somewhat ambivalent in speaking about her grandfather, Constant Lacorne, our Klansman, because the civil rights movement was in full flood and the narrative was changing, if you like, about the white supremacists.
What did you initially do with this information when she told you?
Well, nothing.
Nothing.
Again, I was a boy. And family lore comes to children. Like everything else, it's a part of life. Many years later, which is to say 10 years ago, I inherited some of the papers and files of this aunt, Maud Lacorne, and in them I found or rediscovered our Klansman, and I thought that it would be a story to investigate. I tried to write a novel about our Klansman, and I did not do very well, and I put the material away. And then the geysers of white supremacist violence began to erupt. The Charleston, South Carolina massacre at Emmanuel AME Church, and the police killings of Michael Brown and Tamir Rice and Freddie Gray and Philando Castile. And I decided I would try to write nonfiction, a piece of history about this man, a biography of a Klansman, to try to tell what happens to a family when it submerges itself in white supremacist ideology.
What was your research process like?
Well, there are very few records left by most Americans. Maybe one in 500 people leave a paper trail of diaries and letters and what have you. And this man was a carpenter and a poor, struggling, working man, and he left no paper trail except that in public records. And so I spent years excavating the sacramental records, the tax records, the newspapers, the property transfers, the court records, piecing together one nugget at a time, facts and episodes in his life. It was like panning for a precious metal, and assembling these nuggets onto a table.
What was a moment or a time in your research or writing this book that really challenged you intellectually?
I began to stories of massacres, race massacres, one after another, and it appears that our ancestor participated in a killing episode in 1866 at a place called Mechanics Hall in New Orleans, in which 200 black people were shot to death for rallying for voting rights. And this floored me and still floors me. But there happens to be in American history a long, long catalog of race riots, as we call them, which are effectively white mob violence directed towards people of color throughout American memory. And during Reconstruction, there were 100 episodes of this kind in the Deep South, and it shocks you when you try to recount these stories.
What did you learn from writing your previous book, Slaves and the Family, that was useful in writing this book?
I wrote my book, Slaves and the Family, 22 years ago, about my father's family in Charleston, South Carolina, who were major slaveholders for 170 years. And in that book, I sought out African-American families whose ancestors our family had once enslaved. And what I learned was to excavate the poisonous veins of American memory can have a medicinal and positive effect. And in this case, The Life of a Klansman tells the story of my mother's family, who happened to have a white supremacist militant in its midst. And to return to these painful stories can have a balming effect. That's what I learned.
My guest is Edward Ball, Life of a Klansman, A Family History in White Supremacy. So New Orleans obviously factors in quite a bit into this story. What were some of the characteristics of New Orleans during the time that Constant was alive? And what were some of the specific attitudes about race during this time?
In the mid-1800s, New Orleans was a multiracial, multicultural city. French and American English, West African, and mixed race, so-called Creoles of color. It was a mélange of societies and tongues, several languages. And the birth of militant white supremacy actually happens after the Civil War. It's not a phenomenon that is even shadowing over the slave period, but after the Civil War, black people and white people are rigidly separated into two racial columns, and white superiority is theorized and broadcast through scholarship and journalism. And that happens because black folks are acquiring their first authority, entering politics, and challenging white domination. So it's a very interesting time, and it's very suggestive for the ensuing history of the rest of the country, because the rest of the country learns from the episodes of white supremacist violence in the South and begins to echo and repeat them.
You go back and tell the story of Constant's parents. Why did you want to tell their stories as well as his?
I talk about Constant's parents, who were, one was a French-born immigrant who came to New Orleans in the early 1800s, and his mother was a Creole woman and slave owner in Louisiana. I wanted to try to bring the reader into what is a very interesting and little-known cultural world of the deep and early American South, which is this place, French-dominated and West African-dominated Creole society, and it's full of interest and curiosity.
My guest is Edward Ball. The name of his book is Life of a Klansman, A Family History in White Supremacy. Do you know why Constant decided to get involved with white supremacist groups? Could you figure that out in your excavation?
What I tried to do was to enter his mind through his world by projection. I found no letters or diaries that would tell the story from his point of view, but it appears from the evidence that he experienced a rapid and serious, class collapse. He mm-hmm. slid from a position of prosperity and some social power to become a struggling workman who was competing in his carpentry work with black craftsmen. And he was one of half a million Confederate veterans who returned home from the Civil War with bitterness and barely concealed rage. And he was one of many tens of thousands who directed his frustration and rage outward toward his neighbors and the people around him.
How did Constant first become involved with the Klan?
It appeared that a fire department, a volunteer fire department, mm-hmm. called the Home Hook and Ladder Department. These fire departments were rife in many cities, and they became the kind of seedbeds for the white militias. He participated in this massacre I mentioned earlier as a member of this fire department, which was sent by the mayor of New Orleans against the black described to break it up. And after that took place, the militias themselves became formalized. The one that he joined first, and which was the most radical, was called the Knights of the White Camellia. Mm-hmm. And then he joined a group called the White League. And these groups formed and then disbanded, and the Ku Klux Klan was in the mix as well. It was a changing constellation of militant men. And as I mentioned, it's not an unusual thing. It's not an aberration for Americans to have a Klansman among one's relatives. I estimate that about 50% of white Americans have, if they chose to look for him, a Klan member in their family tree. And the reality is, of course, that most white people don't know this and perhaps would not want to know it, but it's not at all a fluke or a freak part of our society.
You write of your great-grandfather, Constant is an agent of racist terror, and he is one of us. And then you go on to describe him this way. He's a mediocre man, like a middling salary worker of today. He is bland and ordinary, not heroic, small and empty, not majestic like Satan. He is one of ours. What is useful about emphasizing the normalcy of your great-great-grandfather?
Well, I think that it helps us to see that white supremacy is like an underground river in American history. It waters the roots of our institutions, and it has a virulent undercurrent, and sometimes this normality is broken apart. It bursts to the surface like a geyser, and that is what has happened since about 2015, mm-hmm. I think, in this country, when an angry white racist cohort has been aroused like an eruption. And so I think that some degree of acknowledgement of how deeply white supremacy is embedded in our national memory is good. It is a normal part of our history, and this river goes back underground, but it never goes away.
Throughout the book, you chronicle the history of white supremacist ideas, pointing to magazines and newspapers, minstrel shows that Constant likely encountered, and you also tend to push back on this idea that if I had been alive during that time, I would have acted differently. Why did you want to remind the reader of the ways Constant had been introduced and indoctrinated in some way into white supremacy?
Well, we flatter ourselves by looking at people like Constant Le Corne as remote and alien others. We think of them as the ignorant people who were unfortunate enough to have lived before our own enlightened era of racial progress. We condescend to people of that period, and we give for being better than they are. So I try to get close to what a family of mid-19th century white Southerners might have felt, experienced, thought, in a way to normalize their lives and to treat them as full humans, which they were. And is it actually true that I, if I lived at that time, would have become a part of the resistance when the majority of my comrades and family and friends were on the side of fierce political action? And it would flatter me to make that claim.
What has it been like to publish a book called Life of a Klansman, A Family History in White Supremacy, in the middle of a civil rights movement regarding race and police brutality?
Right. Well, some might say that this book, this story, is somehow describing today. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a doppelganger of our current moment. I mean, conspicuously, white domination of public affairs is unrelenting, and black households have 1/10 of the wealth of white, and a caste system in labor persists, and mass incarceration cripples large swaths of the 40 million African American community. However, this summer, a movement has arrived with waves of marches and mass talk of systemic racism and a tide of reflection by influencers. I think that a lot of white Americans are expressing a burst of race awareness, and You know, whites are filling the protest ranks and using slogans about black lives and pulling down statues of successful racists. And that's all good. There's a reckoning that appears to be going on. And since we have been submerged in a kind of tribal racism, if you like, by the tides coming from Washington since 2016, now there seems to be a levee going up against that tide, and that's good. Hey, I'm going to do an event tonight that I would like to talk about. May I do that?
Yeah, real quick. You've got 25 seconds.
Tonight at the New York Public Library on Zoom, look for 8 p.m. Live from nypl.org.
Our partners here at WNYC, so we'll tweet that out for you. Edward Ball, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much, Allison.
This is all of it.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.